Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Kendra, I really came to introduce the Reverend Alan Jones of Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. He's dean of the cathedral there, which to us Mormons, I guess the best way to explain that is that he's in charge of that very large congregation, which, as he was telling me coming over here, is growing. And as the major church in San Francisco, that's a significant position. He was born in London. He was educated in English schools. He has a significant theological background. One of the most interesting things he's done, as I was discussing with him, is the Center for Christian Spirituality that he established at the General Theological Seminary in New York. He's a teacher, of course, and a writer, and I would commend to you, to your attention, his book, but the most recent one called Soul Making, the Desert Way of Spirituality. So it's a remarkably good book. And he's here to talk with us and then to share with you. The topic of his talk is Make Way for the Image of God, an Explanation of Christian Anthropology. Alan?
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, very much. Title of the talk, Make Way for the Image of God, which I won't refer to much, but will serve as a kind of springboard, comes from one of the marvelous statements of the medieval rabbis, who claimed that if we could see them, every human being is preceded by a legion of angels saying, make way for the image of God, make way for the image of God. And it's a way of pointing to the inalienable dignity of every human person and the importance of that. I want to concentrate with you in these minutes given me about Christian anthropology, that is the doctrine, the theological doctrine of the human person, and why I think it's an important subject today. Our problem, I think, or one of our problems in society, is that we stagger from issue to issue, all of these issues having some bearing on Christian anthropology. Issues about sexuality, issues about human behavior. And we stagger from issue to issue, whether it's about abortion or homosexuality, for example, and yet we don't have any overarching vision of what a human being is. We don't have a context in which to argue. And sometimes we need common ground so that we can disagree with each other and not simply agree. And what passes for debate is really an unedifying display of people exchanging slogans with each other and anathematizing their opponents. So we need some common ground if we're going to disagree, let alone agree. My vision of humanity is that to be human is to be make a response to the word of God given us, that to be human is a response to a call to glory. And this vision of humanity as a response to a voice, the voice of God, serves as an antidote to three contemporary dangers that I think you're all aware of. Reductionism, that is reducing human beings to things. Inflation, which is the opposite almost of blowing us up and talking about ourselves as God, although I think there's obviously grounds for talking about divinity in humanity. And the third danger, the danger of disembodiment, trying to get out of the body. Reductionism with regard to the dignity of persons is encouraged by both a shallow view of science and the degeneration of politics into management, which sees people as both disposable and dispensable. Inflation, as a direct response to this threat of being reduced, comes out in various religious and quasi-religious cults that are very busy trying to win our divinity back by telling us that we are gods. The terrible disease of AIDS has become the metaphor of disembodiment. If we become too embodied with each other, it will kill us. And these three contemporary dangers play a descant on ancient themes. Are we angels or are we beasts? And what I think we all need is a revisioning of humanity. So I want to concentrate this afternoon on the vision of the human being as a response to a call, And in two particular ways, the call to solidarity with one another and the call to self-knowledge. To be human then is to be on a voyage of self-knowledge, but also a voyage into community. Both involve facing brokenness and loss, and I think you will be able to draw your own conclusions with regard to the implications for issues surrounding love and justice. So let me give you two quotations to get us going. I start with Saint Augustine and one of the Greek fathers of the church, Saint Gregory Nazianzus. Saint Augustine wrote this in his commentary on the Psalms. Adam means the whole earth. Once he was in a single place, then he fell, was split into fragments, and filled the whole earth. But the mercy of God collected the pieces from everywhere, melted them in the fire of his love, and fused together again what had been broken. A fragmented humanity which needs to be brought together again. And then St. Gregory, who says, "Know thyself, my friend, understand your origin and your nature. The road to the beauty of the archetype is very straight." Now these two quotations speak to the double secret of human identity. If we take Augustine really seriously, the first secret is that humanity is something that we share. It isn't something that we own individually. In fact, we do not have any identity apart from each other. And the second secret, according to St. Gregory, is that our humanity is discovered and uncovered insofar as we respond to the call of self-knowledge. Now, the Russians have a word, cirkovnost, which is hard to translate. It's kind of a togetherness in the spirit. It affirms a consciousness that salvation is universal, and that no one may believe that he is saved unless he is saved together with others, that there is no private salvation. This, of course, is not crude universalism as such, but merely the insistence that we are called to a universal hope. And from a uniquely Christian perspective, the unity of human nature has nothing to do with narrowly conceived biological or sociological factors. The unity of human nature is the unity of the Holy Spirit. In fact, the Holy Spirit is what we share in common. So if you were to ask yourself, what's the most real thing about me? It won't be answered in terms of sexuality or cleverness or particular gifts. The most real thing about you is that you are one who is loved by God. That is the most real thing. And if that is accepted in faith, then you don't have to lie to yourself about anything else. You can then proceed, and you may be a whole host of other horrors, I don't know. You may be, you know, a terrible list of things, but the most real thing about you is that you're one who is loved by God. Or to put it in terms of the Christian East, a human being is made up of body, mind, and Holy Spirit. And it's the Holy Spirit in you that is calling you to that a greater and greater reality. There is then no private humanity or exclusive spirituality. And this can sound very un-American, because we have such an individualistic view of our lives and particularly of our religion. This vision affirms that we need each other if the fullness of humanity is to be realized. And we not only need each other, we need to know our need and live from it. The acknowledgement of our need for each other then is the action of the love of God, which draws us towards divinization. And that, so therefore we have three concepts which can inform this vision of humanity. Collectivity from St. Augustine, that is that humanity is something I share with you, and that there isn't, I cannot be me without you, and you cannot be you without me. Self-knowledge from St. Gregory, and a divinized humanity from the Eastern Church, that we're going somewhere and that humanity hasn't happened yet. That humanity is something that's growing and evolving, and that the new is always breaking in. And I think this provides a creative and open context in which to ask the necessary and vexing question, what is therefore normal? Some of you may have seen the musical that's been going on for years in New York City called The Fantastics. It must be in its, I don't know, 90th year, it feels like. And the heroine in that musical stands at front stage and says, "Oh God, please don't make me normal." And that whole vision of normalcy is something that's rather deadening. Well, I want to suggest a view of the norm which is exciting. What can we say that it is normative of human beings? Do we have a nature? It seems that it is impossible to talk about human beings and their antics without some appeal to nature, even if we cannot agree with regard to its meaning. Even the vapid and shallow appeal to loving intentions is as somehow normative, is an attempt to appeal to our true natures. That is, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you do it in a loving way. Or it's okay if it feels good, is a norm of sorts. But we know only too well that our intentions are often misleading and distorted, and that the road to hell is paved with them. The Eastern Christian tradition talks of our conversion as simply a return to our first nature, the one willed by God. If only we could find it. The normative Judeo-Christian assertion is, of course, that we're made after the image of God, which affirms our first call to an ever-widening and deepening celebration of solidarity with one another. And this primary vocation is further affirmed by the doctrine of the Holy and Undivided Trinity in the Christian tradition, that a person is only truly in God's image in fellowship with other people. That's what the Trinity means in its impact of our self-understanding, that if we're made after the image of God, and God is a Trinitarian God, there's a community of persons, then if we're made after the image of God, we only truly reflect the image of God insofar as we're willing to be formed into community with other people. So we affirm that the image of God on earth is a community of persons. But today, the odd or the idiosyncratic has triumphed over the normative. And we see this in the modern world. One critic has writing on the villains in Shakespeare's King Lear asserts, "Neither in modern literature nor in modern life are there characters any more amoral, rapacious, more energetically and even erotically nihilistic, like a punk rock pop star, than Edmund, Goneril, Regan and Cornwall in the play. As Alfred Harbidge has noted, even in that curious product of our times, the liberalism gone to seed, which automatically defends anything from treachery to sadism, providing it savours of nonconformity, has had little to say for these insatiable figures." The question that faces us today, and why I think the issue of our vision is important, is do we have the spiritual resources to reject the warring anthropologies of a liberalism gone to seed in our culture on the one hand, and of a conservative, locked-in, rigid, fixed view of human nature on the other? Terrible choice between a kind of flakiness that's going nowhere and a rigid affirmation of tightness which is killing us. We need to be aware of these warring anthropologies that vie for our attention, and we need to recover spiritual disciplines of discernment and discrimination and discretion which will confront us with the anthropological images by which we unconsciously live or half live or move deeply into a kind of dying. There are many examples of the dominant anthropology at work in our culture, and I don't know whether I should be treading on any toes, but we'll see. I'll try. Think, for instance, of those who are seeking spiritual guidance through channeling. It is based on an optimistic, individualistic, and largely self-serving vision of the self. Our heart's desire is within our grasp because of the conviction that we are masters of our own destiny. All this on the authority of Ramtha, a 35,000-year-old warrior. The message, however, sounds startlingly contemporary and trivial. It is the gospel of hassle-free individualism, relying largely on a high income to relieve one of a life with some moral bite to it. Everyone is his or her own God. The only reality there is one's own reality. And it's pretty trite stuff. And for an increasing number of middle and upper middle class Americans, as well as celebrities like Shirley MacLaine, the channeling movement seems to offer an exotic way to spiritual fulfillment. But underneath these various visions of humanity, from a reductionist pessimism to Rantha's inflationary optimism, are the two deceptively simple questions that need to be answered before we get entangled in the thorny and complex issues facing the human race. The questions are, what is a human being, and what is a human being for? They lurk unanswered beneath every issue that faces us. And as I said at the beginning, we suffer from issue-oriented times. It's not that the issues aren't important, but that we have no overarching context in which to place our arguments, discussions, and confrontations. We've no horizon against which to place the things which are stretching, probing, and tormenting us. Our self-definitions are too narrow, too privatized to give us anything but an individualistic and narcotic hope. Our vision with regard to our possibilities and obligations far too shallow to forge a commonwealth of persons. We have no coherent vision of the self related to other selves, which mediates to us hope for the future. Make no mistake, there are vital issues facing us. The important issues of homophobia, sexism, and racism, with their attendant problems of prejudice, sexual identity, and abortion, to name a few. They cannot be dealt with positively without some critical framework. But many of us have rejected, and I think quite rightly, the older framework of an anthropology based on patriarchy, dualism, and hierarchy. But these categories persist as inadequate reminders of our longing for order, for complementarity, and a sense of place. It's always interesting. I know in my own church, and I know in church history, of how churches, whatever color or denomination, are inherently conservative and resistant to the new breaking in. And it's always interesting to see how churches as institutions are open to new ideas. It's very hard for them to shift and to change. But they do, and they inevitably change. In Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, Thomas More, the erstwhile King's Chancellor, Thomas More's daughter, Margaret, tries to argue her father into submitting to the King's will in the matter of his divorce. "It's not your fault," she says, "that the state's three-quarters bad. Then if you elect to suffer for it, you elect yourself a hero." And Thomas More replies, "That's very neat, but look, if we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us good, and greed would make us saintly. And we'd live like animals or angels in the happy land that needs no heroes. But since, in fact, we see that avarice, anger, envy, pride, sloth, lust, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond humility, chastity, fortitude, justice, and thought, and have to choose to be human at all," that's the key phrase, "and have to choose to be human at all, why then perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of being heroes. According to this view, we are neither angels nor animals. Being and becoming human has something to do with virtue, with struggling with the good for the good. Being human involves suffering, and suffering of a peculiar sort, willed suffering for the sake of the good. Sacrifice is at the heart of being human, no matter how that truth rankles in the heart of the modern consciousness." What I mean by sacrifice has got much more of a positive ring. The best example I can give of it is in John Cheever's novel, The Wapshot Chronicles, where an elderly Bostonian aunt is a devotee of the Boston Red Sox. Are they Boston? Yes. And she stands up in the bleachers and yells. This elderly lady yells at the team, "Sacrifice, you booby! Sacrifice!" And it's that vision of sacrifice that I want to you give of yourself, and it's going to be stretching and painful. Because I believe real personhood is an invitation to sacrifice. In the Christian scheme of things, the process is profoundly Trinitarian. Each person of the Trinity exists not by excluding others, not by defining himself or herself as over against others, but by a refusal to possess the nature for himself or herself. Persons always exist in relation to and towards another. A person, therefore, can be fully personal only insofar as there is nothing that he or she seeks to possess for himself to the exclusion of others. We, however, tend to exist, frail and fallen as we are, by excluding each other. Each of us affirms himself by contrasting himself with others. And paradoxically, our real and full individuality is given free rein when we accept that we are made of the same stuff as other people, that we are consubstantial. I am what my brother, my sister is. My brother or my sister is my life. That is what I think Christian anthropology is trying to affirm. In the deepest sense, being and becoming human is a matter of choice. It's a response to a call. It's not something automatic. We have to decide to be human. Sir Thomas More has a high view of human nature, and there have always been low and high views, as there have been static and fluid ones. Whatever our view of human nature, including those of us who think that there is no such thing, it has a profound effect on our attitudes and behavior. The woman who told me that having an abortion was no different from pruning a tree revealed a great deal of her overall view of human nature. We couldn't come to a meeting of minds that night. What of the reductive naturalism prevalent in the culture? Is Stephen Jay Gould on track when he asserts a crab is no lower nor less complex than a human being in any meaningful way? Or Jacob Bronowski, man is part of nature in the same sense that a stone is, or a cactus, or a camel. Is there any room or warrant for mind, conscience, will, or obligation, but only for energetic, amoral exertion in the struggle for survival, power, and status? I don't know any crabs who have written symphonies. And I don't know any crabs who have libraries. So I do think this, of course we're rooted in nature, but there's something else working out in us that is very important to affirm. Some people have been so crippled by over-idealized high views of human nature that they believe that the low road is the only option. In a way, we need both routes for our self-understanding. We need to have our feet firmly on terra firma if we are to explore the terra incognita, the unknown land of our being and becoming human. Our heads then should be in the clouds, but our feet must be planted in the earth. Now, there are two great dissuasives against our entering the debate at all. The first is Freud's devastating and some would say terminal attack on the reliability of rational processes. The second, I think, nowadays, is our apparently incurably romantic view of sexuality. It's very difficult to inject ideas of fallenness and sin into any discussions of sexuality without being called Puritan or listening to some cheap shots at St. Augustine. Nevertheless, there is an intractable relationship between all talk about human nature and issues concerning sin and suffering and wholeness and glory. Religion, sex, despair, fallenness and sin cannot be avoided in any exploration of human nature. Neither can issues of love, whether rightly ordered or disordered. What the mystical tradition calls our inordinate affections have to be considered if a realistic and visionary context is to be provided for our self-understanding. In more positive terms, questions concerning human identity have a dramatic shape or storyline. There is always movement. Movement from non-being and back again. Movement from triviality to martyrdom, as T.S. Eliot put it. Our culture, however, does not have a coherent vision of the human person. because it lacks any storyline of truly mythic proportions, which could not only provide metaphors for this self-understanding I'm asking for, but also the social structure which will hold us together in community and communion. There is, in short, a kind of mythic crisis. A mythic crisis, which I say as a footnote, the mythic crisis which has driven me to come to Salt Lake City to participate in a conversation with a tradition about which I know next to nothing and about which I have a tremendous collection of prejudices. And to be invited into a conversation, it seems to me a very important thing to be happening in our culture where we're so divided from each other. And it seems to me this is a very worthwhile healing and positive shift. The dangers, though, are great. A kind of false romanticism, a cruel idealism which can grip us. But if the dangers are great, so are the rewards. The low road had its dangers too. Reductionism posing as realism, despair masquerading as common sense. But I follow the dictum of Nicholas Berdyaev, the Russian philosopher, that man without God is no longer man. Humanity without God is no longer human. And to be fully human, we require relationship with that transcendent other we call God, that other who continually calls us into being. And our humanness is deficient without a breakthrough from God. We are confronted then with the muddle and mystery of human beings. As such, we are constantly asking questions of each other. It's said that Mozart asked everyone he met, "Do you love me?" in a sort of innocent way. "Do you love me?" And I see that question in the eyes of everyone I meet. It's only for a second, you know, and then we either back off and be polite, or we see who's going to get each other first, or whatever it is. But the first glimpse is, "Do you love me?" And then it goes away again. Do you love me? Do I matter? And if the hurt is too deep, the question is rejected and replaced by another. No one can love me. And from that basic lie, which is a lie, spring the horrors of human diminishment. Much of the modern view of humanity is based then on a pessimistic and despairing materialism masquerading as a liberating spirituality. Dale Kohler, the youthful and naive apologist for a discoverable God, a God that you can find by computer, in John Updike's novel Roger's Version, he insists materialism is a faith just like theism, only it asks a lot more in the way of miracles. Instead of asking that we believe in God, it asks that we don't believe in ourselves. It asks that we don't believe in our own awareness, our own emotions and moral sensations. That's why I think we tend to hire spiritual ventriloquists, which I see as basically TV evangelism. Why we hire spiritual ventriloquists to mouth our words and emotions for us. That's why we elect politicians to manage the outside world so that we might the better enjoy the prison of our private freedoms. Who wouldn't seek relief from this sort of relentless view of self? What I'd like to end with and leave some time, because then I'd like to ask to talk with each other, since I think the numbers permit that, so I'm not going to give the whole presentation, and I think it'll end up partly in print. And I understand it says, "Attention speakers, your session is being recorded." I take nothing back then. John Updike. I get a lot of my theology on theologizing from modern novels, and John Updike's in what must surely be his nastiest novel, Roger's Version, forces us to take a hard look at our well-documented fallenness and to wrestle with the intractable themes of our humanness. He provides an antidote to the mindless optimism of those trapped in their own psyche looking for their special destiny.
This is the end of side one.
It seeks to remedy. His vision of humanity requires five things. I'm going to run through them quickly and then we can talk about them. His vision of humanity requires five things if we wish to live into what it is to be human. if we are to respond to this call from God to be fully human in community. On every level, you should note, though, that on every level, on every level of the five levels, there is always resistance. The first is a need for a breakthrough from God. Blessed is he who knows his need of God, and don't underestimate our resistance to that. The second is the commitment to focused attention to what is there. That means the refusal to lie about yourself. The problem with many religious people is that they make a patchwork quilt of their lives from the nice bits, the good bits. And therefore there are large areas of who we are left out. So the second thing is a commitment to focused attention to what's there. Three, the courage to face the pain of what we've seen. Because if you are willing to look, then what you look at might not always be pleasant. So the first is a breakthrough from God. The second is a willingness to look. The third is a willingness to bear the pain of what you have to see. And the fourth is this gift of discernment, to see the glory underneath. Because you then, having dared to look, having faced the pain, you may be seduced into thinking that the mess you've looked at is all there is, and you then have forgotten that the most real thing about you is that you are loved by God. So that the fourth is the gift of discernment, and the fifth is the willingness to face death. Now, with regard to the breakthrough from God, Dale Kohler, this young student computer freak who wants to prove God exists by the use of a computer, he confronts the divinity professor Roger, of the title of the book Roger's Version, Roger Lambert, with Roger's arid Barthian religion. And he says, you don't want God to break through. People in general don't want that. They just want to grub along being human and dirty and sly and amusing and having their weekends with Michelob, and God to stay put in the churches if they ever decide to drop by, and maybe to pull them out at the end down the tunnel of light that all these near-death experiences talk about. It's a kind of use of God, a kind of God that Voltaire talked about. Remember that in the beginning God created man in his own image, and ever since man has been returning the compliment. A kind of domesticated God, a God who's in your hip pocket when you need a God. The cynical theology professor fulfills the second requirement of focused attention, but the gift is wasted on him. He has a gift of seeing things, but then he backs off from it. There's a wonderful couple of sentences where he notices a tree, and he says to himself, I even stopped on the pavement of this unsavory neighborhood in Boston to ponder more deeply that tall ginkgo tree with its gong-like golden color. There are so few things which, contemplated, do not, like flimsy trapdoors, open under the weight of our attention into the bottomless pit below. He's saying that if you look, even at a leaf, that if you give something your attention, it's like a trapdoor that will lead you into an abyss or into a great mystery, the bottomless pit. So he withdraws from prayer and attentiveness because it leads into mystery. He's willing to look, but not look long and deep enough to be detached from his aching, tenacious and voracious ego, so that he can respond to the voice that is calling him to being. And even his rage sounds hollow, although it points to real pain. Facing the pain is the third requirement, and he finds that very, very, very difficult. And in an extraordinarily resonant passage, Updike bears witness to what we have lost when we are not in touch with our pain. Lambert reflects, after an emotional outburst from his niece, Verna, on the fact that our humanity is constantly being diminished by our insistence on control and manageability. His niece, a feisty, difficult girl, young woman, has had an outburst in front of him, and he thinks about her behavior, and he says, more role-playing, I said to myself, and not especially well-played. Westerners have lost whole octaves of passion. It's an interesting phrase. Westerners have lost whole octaves of passion. Third world women can still make an inhuman, piercing, grieving noise right from the floor of the soul. as you can see and hear on television clips from Lebanon and Ethiopia. There's a sad picture. You can see and hear a woman who has this vast range of passion, but you can only see it on television clips. It's rather like watching people make love and never loving. To be human is to respond to the voice calling us from the floor of the soul. And no wonder we resist it, because it introduces us to octaves of passion. Hear also what Updike says on youth. He refers to youth as the mountain range that isolates it in the valley far from which isolates it in the valley far from our own grows steeper. As capitalism even more ferociously exploits youth as a separate market, beaming at it whole new worlds of potential expenditure, home video games and rear entry ski boots, and a million bits of quasi-musical whining cut out by laser into compact discs. Ever more informational technique, ever more inane information. Another thing that dehumanizes us. We've got informational technique, but empty information itself. We do not want the gift of discernment. We would rather have indiscriminate information. I don't know whether any of you saw that not very successful, in fact, some dismal mini-series called America with a K about the possible Russian takeover of this country. I watched maybe 20 minutes in all the whole series, but I did see the segment where the whole United States Senate was wiped out. It came into the chamber and was machine gunned by Russians posing as American revolutionaries. And this whole carnage, the picture faded, and I wasn't sure whether we were still going on. And the ad came on that this segment was brought to you courtesy of Jell-O pudding. But there was no difference. And in fact, the ad was a little louder and more focused than the picture. Everything is given equal weight. And it's very hard to discriminate. And it's very hard then to face serious questions. We resist them. And why not opt for a religion which serves as a narcotic? Why not go in for a narcotic religion? And why not have a Bayer aspirin view of God? You take God three times a day and you won't feel a thing. A view of religion as a narcotic, and it infects and affects all denominations, all religions. But religion, far from a great adventure into the mystery of God, is our anesthetizing us against it. I say to people, if you really want to be sure of avoiding a living encounter with God, then come to church every Sunday. It's like getting vaccinated so you don't catch the real thing. And if you want to be utterly certain, I suggest ordination. Because then you can be in the business of trying to keep the show on the road. So you have to be, this issue of discernment is very important. The way a religion functions in people's lives psychologically is often to avoid the very thing that religion is supposed to stand for. And that goes, that's across the board. Well, let me come to my some kind of conclusion so that we can have some time for discussion, because I'd rather hear from you in the last few minutes. It seems that human beings cannot get along without this call to sacrifice, this claim to divinity, that there is something more, that we are, there is in me, as one philosopher put it, there is in me something more me than myself. And we can anesthetize it, we can repress it, we can do all sorts of things about it, but it comes out one way or the other. The question is, which of the gods, with a small g, do we find ourselves imitating? Each of us has a loyalty to a divinity. The question is, which one? Belief in the God who was in Christ is very different from belief in modern Promethean claims. Faustian humanity came to an end, the end of its rope, some time ago. Remember the idea of a heroic genius found in the pure race of a chosen people? Hitler. In Hitler's case, an Aryan, male, all-knowing and all-seeing, above the law and a law to himself, a persuasive speaker and a powerful commander of those who are ready to die for the mission of their race. Hitler wrote in his seminal book, Mein Kampf, "Whatever we possess today in terms of human culture, works of art, scholarship and science, is almost exclusively the creative product of Aryans. Exactly this fact allows the well-founded conclusion that the Aryan alone is the originator of a higher order of humanity, and this the prototype of everything we designate with the word human. The Aryan is the Prometheus of humanity, from whose luminous head went forth at all times the divine spark of the genius." Now this view, which is an anthropology, and it is based on a belief in God, a God of sorts, this view is far from dead. That's why we need to embrace the discipline of deepening and broadening our patterns of self-definition. Be committed to self-knowledge. My two tests, remember, for a growing humanity is a commitment to self-knowledge and a commitment to solidarity with our sisters and brothers. Today, for example, we all suffer from the pervasiveness of male and white imagery with regard to the definition of persons. As a nation, we may not be in danger of contrasting our own superior and divinely authorized genius with the inferior race of the Jews, as did Hitler and his Aryan movement, but we constantly affirm our own mission in the world by contrasting ourselves with other nations which are downgraded as less democratic, less wealthy and less successful and less peace-loving, or even barbaric or satanic, as we seek our own interests and not those of others. So we have a lot of homework to do. I as a Christian subscribe then to another vision of the divine human being, as one that recognizes the presence of divinity in all human beings, regardless of race or gender, and in friend and enemy alike. Because, I follow St. Augustine, Adam means the whole earth. Once he was in a single place, then he fell, was split into fragments and filled the whole earth. But the mercy of God collected the pieces from everywhere, melted them in the fire of his love, and fused together again what had been broken. And what healing would come if we could communicate to each other that every human being, whoever he or she is, those who are despised and rejected, every human being is preceded by a legion of angels shouting, make way for the image of God. That could have powerful political and social dynamic implications. Thank you for your patience. I'd like to come down among you and see if we can generate 10 minutes worth of discussion.
This is the end of this cassette.